You are listening to the Poetry Saloncast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to make inspiration, education, and an inspiring community affordable and available to poets and writers around the world. To find out more about our workshops, classes, editing services, and events, visit www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, please enjoy our interview with this month's guest poet.
Stretch marks. Follow the lines and find yourself. Before a man named you fat ass and pussy, before a man made you stand on scales, before a man learned about roses and concrete, taught you how flowers wilt and bruised your soul into cement. Follow the lines as you were meant to, rigorously, as you have fled their guidance, before man made you believe in perfect, before you realized the trick, that under the bark, they were lost too, hurt too, worshiping false gods for fear of reconciling their interiors with their mass. Follow them back to before man up, where you were forced to leave the boy. Him, fat-fingered and sensitive, find him. Tell him that vulnerability is a muscle. Squeeze his cheeks. Tell him that his brain is enough, that he is enough. Remind him. Make sure, if nothing else, he knows this. He is loved. Boy speaks to the River Jordan. I'm a mess, mama. Stress, mama. Blessed and out east now, hair down and carefree, but blue, black, and guilty as ever, mama. He dead, mama. We only got the whispers left. Demons poltergeist in these poems, only the ones that ain't about the dead. She more alive than me, mama. I'm more free, mama. I got five on that commissary, very forward thinking of me, mama. Huh? Yes, mama. I'm blessed, mama. You stressed and still home, still thin-blooded and wide mouth, laughter-licked flesh, mama. Catfish and spaghetti plates with the hot sauce, without the church, mama. Why we stop going to church, mama? Do God ever visit the hood, mama? I once saw a mom cry out for him, but he sent his messengers with yellow tape to package a new angel. Ain't you say we are angels, mama? That these razor backbones of mine mean I once had wings? That I once flew to Jordan and back before a school, mama? That we once weighed in water and all white came out all black and all white, mama? Will we be all right, mama? I tried to be Mecca for myself, but I need help, mama. Even angels need help, mama. Jesus need help. His black skin be loud. I hear it even over the studio smoke, mama. And you know what, mama? I'm blessed. And I'll be home soon. Pocket full of degrees, all full of myself, ready for you and granny to stuff me whole. Give me cornbread, sweet as Skittles. I can't wait for you to kiss my hoodie safe, mama. Call me boy how you do when you forget my name. It always lights the way home. Hold me in your lap like I'm still your baby and the world can't tell you nothing about your baby. I know I'm too tall to see you in your eyes, but no body of mine can outgrow the roots you smiled into my spine, mama. I'm on my way now, mama. Home.
Hello, Poetry Saloncast listeners. You have been listening to the poems of Deshaun McKinney. Deshaun McKinney is a writer from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. His art, grounded in hip hop, explores the delicate balance of existence. Deshaun has built audiences around the world from Kingston, Jamaica to London, England. He holds an MSc in social policy from the London School of Economics and Political Science and an MA in poetry from the University of East Anglia. His work appears in journals such as Lowell and Glass. The winner of the 2021 River Heron Poetry Prize, his debut chapbook, Father Forgive Me, was published in 2021 by Black Sunflowers Poetry Press. Deshaun, we are so happy to have you here today. I like to say a little bit about like how I know poets personally, and this one is really self-congratulatory, but you won the 2021 River Heron Press Prize. And I really enjoy that journal. I had a poem published in one of their earlier issues. So I submitted And I had a poem that was a finalist for that prize. And I remember reading your critique, you know, of my poem and why you liked it and why you chose it as a finalist. And I had never had such a close reading of my own work. It was such a strange, bizarre situation to be on the other side, because I'm usually the one that, you know, close reads another poem and critiques it for an essay or to help other people understand it. So to be on the other end of that and have someone close reading my work was strange, I think really a wonderful privilege. And I loved what you had to say about it. And I just, now I want to know what this writer writes. And I just read Father Forgive Me from Sunflower, from Black Sunflower Press. And I really enjoyed that collection. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm glad that my words resonated. I know it's an interesting thing when the tables are turned and somebody else is doing the deep dive, but I think there's something really beautiful when you feel seen as a result of the deep dive, right? Like, okay, I think there are different levels of engagement that come with any piece of artwork, and there can be something different, like the minutia with fellow practitioners of the craft. And so like really seeing, you may notice the thing that I, you know, the Easter egg I snuck in there that most people may not get, but then it's right there. Or even sometimes I always talk about how a single word can, the whole entire piece turns on that word. And a lot of people may not know it, but if you're also writing in the same way, you may understand why that "and" put right here is the whole crux. So I'm glad that whatever I wrote resonated with you in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if listeners want to do the deep dive and follow us down the rabbit hole, the poem that Deshaun read of mine is Territorial Boundaries, which is in my book, When the Moon Had Antlers. And it's, you know, quite a bit about critique of modern day civilization. And I've read a number of your poems and noticed kind of a similar thread, certainly a lot of questioning of where our world comes from, our modern world comes from. But I really want to focus today on the chapbook, Father Forgive Me. And I want to ask a little bit about how you, well, first I want to ask a little bit about how you came to poetry, because you studied, you know, what some might call more, you know, lofty, academic, rigorous subjects, economics and politics, and then go to get your MFA. Can you say a little bit about that journey and how you made that switch, if you have made that switch?
Yeah, I think it's funny because the scholarship that I got to for grad school over in England, I think they asked me a similar question when I was telling them, here's my game plan, which is like policy. And then, hey, I'm going to go study poetry as well. And they're kind of like, make it make sense. Like, I don't know if I understand the connection or what's happening here. And I think for a lot of people, if I'm being honest, part of that confusion is we're taught so young that to be successful, you got to do one thing and you have to shed the other parts of yourself to conform to whatever that is. Like to be in the professional world, you can't move like this. Like you can't, I'm wearing a Death Row shirt right now with a turban on, I've got locks. There's all these things that are like antithetical to traditional professional spaces. I mean, I've tattoos, you see all this going on, right? Like I've got a lot going on. But for me, I've always been somebody who firmly believes you can be your full self and do the things that you want to do. Now my full self means it's the creative and it's the person who's deeply invested in policy and doing, serving a larger cause much greater than myself. And so it all works in tandem for me. And I even think, you know, when I was in my undergrad, I did a lot of grassroots organizing work. My time in college was the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement. I was in the streets all the time. And we would have these kind of conversations about how do you get a message across to people? And there's only so far that statistics, numbers, facts can go for some people. And it doesn't necessarily, it won't necessarily penetrate their reasoning and their understanding. There's a humanistic element to art that breaks through in a different way. There's a much more universal thing to, if I'm telling you this human experience, it allows you to see, oh, that's a person. Yeah. Oh, so like maybe they're not lazy. Maybe they're actually working three jobs. One of them's a maid. One is at this Amazon fulfillment center. They got three kids. Everything they have is going to rent, bills, food. They haven't had a vacation in years. Oh, they're actually working really hard. I just didn't know the ins and outs of that experience. I'm just hearing that people on welfare are taking advantage of the system and they're getting massive checks so they don't, you know what I mean? Like there's the numbers And then there's the human side of things. And I think art can bring up that humanistic element. So for me, there's a clear tie into these things. But I think on a more basic level, for me, it wasn't a switch because there's just two sides of who I am. You know what I mean? I've always done these things.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, this kind of lights up a lot of the buttons that live in my head, you know, because I remember some kind of quote a few years ago, and I don't know who said it, but someone said, you know, we used to think the sciences were so important. The sciences were going to tell us how to fix the planet and all these, you know, useful things. But really, it's pretty useless if we can't communicate to people what we need to do. So like, we know what we need to do to fix the environment, but if you can't communicate to people that we have something we need to do differently, it's useless to have that information, you know? So I think what we're kind of starting to recognize is like, you know, the role of the communicators, the artists, the people who can make us see more, you know, see and feel and then act and respond, hopefully, are a lot more important than I think we used to give them credit for. And that's, of course, where poets like us come into the picture, yeah. You know? So when you went from sociology and economics into poetry, have you found a way to combine the two of them? You know, are you using both of, you know, the knowledge that you have from both of those in some way?
I think so. I think I do a ton of different things. So I'm a director of development right now for the Wisconsin Foundation and Alumni Association. So which means I fundraise for the hospital system here. So we have an academic medical center, which is the University of Wisconsin Health and the School of Medicine and Public Health. And so I'm a part of the frontline fundraising team for them. And so my whole thing there is I'm there to support equity, access, research, care, treatment, therapy. And to me, that's the serving the greater good. That's the greater good cause. And it ties into in a beautiful way. So I studied social policy at London School of Economics. And so, and it was comparative policy and politics too, because we're talking about what's it like in Germany, what's happening in New Zealand, what's in China, India, so on and so forth. And so for me, you know, healthcare is one of the, I mean, it's a massive tangled web of things. No matter what side of it, what do you think the best solution is? We spend more money than anybody else and our results are not stellar, to say the least.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Of
what you think the solution is, there is an identified problem with our healthcare system. And so I'm working to, the work that I'm doing isn't directly addressing the overarching umbrella, but it is on the ground of like people who are interested in giving back. And a lot of these folks have direct care experiences or family or friends who've been involved. And they're like, hey, I know what this pain has been like. Mm-hmm. I want to give money to make sure to help other people not go through the same thing. Or I know there's no cure now, but maybe with this gift in the future, we can move closer. I want to get you closer to that finish line. Or we have funds that allow people access, like can cover, help you with your mortgage costs. So the care of the cost of care doesn't mean you lose on life, right? So those are the kind of things that I'm working on that I think bridge, work on that in that aspect. I think I've also been doing a lot of teaching lately as well.
Yeah.
You know, I've been getting into that realm to like give it all back and to, you know, spend time with these kids and help them find their own voices in their own way into the world. And poetry is kind of a vehicle and a medium. For some folks, that'll be the thing they continue with. But for a lot of other people, it could just be the thing that opens up the world to them. So I think I do all these things to make sure I'm kind of exercising all parts of me and satisfying the things I need to just be happy with life.
Yeah, that's really very thrilling and comforting for me to hear someone say that, because I definitely feel that way myself. Like, I'm not happy if I'm just doing one thing or focusing on one thing. I compare myself a lot to an octopus. It's just, or actually my little sister, who's a lot more focused on things. She said this to me a few years ago. She's like, Tricia, you're like one of those animals. I'm like, an octopus? No, a mythical animal. A squid? That's not a mythical animal. Those exist. You're like a hydra. Every time you finish one project and we cut off one of your heads, 10 more grow back in its place. And that's definitely how I feel. Like, I definitely need to have multiple outlets and multiple different projects Definitely have been reprimanded and learned my lesson, or tried to learn my lesson, about saying yes to too many things because there are only so many hours in a day. But yeah, I think it's very important for all of us to exercise all of our faculties. It's a lot like the Renaissance man or woman. You know, you weren't supposed to just pick one thing and focus on it to serve capitalism. You were supposed to figure out how to like sing and dance and play the piano and draw and build, what was it that Michelangelo built? You know, you're supposed to like learn sciences and technology and music and art and just, you know, be all that you can be, not to quote the army phrase, but, you know, explore all the different things that a human being can explore and grow and learn. And I think that's something that we, as poets, that's something that I think poetry is naturally able to help us do, you know, like it makes you curious about the world and about what's going on with other people as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's interesting though, because I think younger, when you're starting into engaging with poetry and becoming a writer or becoming a reader of it, I don't think it's that part of it is necessarily intuitive. You're so much into like, I'm studying the craft and the work, that you forget the way that those words were birthed is to be a citizen of the world.
Yeah.
If you need something, you have to engage with this stuff outside of the text. Like, I can't be in the book all day, every day.
Yeah.
Because then I know everything about craft. I'm the perfect writer and I've got nothing to say.
Right. Right, like, yeah.
That's a part of it too, of understanding how much being a citizen of the world, being of the world, engaging with the world and developing questions and your own sorts of answers to it is key towards process as well.
Yeah, I actually, in some ways, I'm kind of glad that poetry doesn't pay a lot of money, because it forces writers and poets to go out and engage with the world, usually to make their living. And then that gives you the material, and it also puts you in contact with other people who maybe aren't writing poetry. So you've got to be a voice for them. So I know there are plenty of poets who didn't have traditional jobs, or they were, you know, housewives and mothers, which are also underappreciated, undervalued jobs, and they still found plenty of things to write about. But I think, I think for all of us, it's important to have something that propels us into writing beyond just, you know, you sitting in a room alone wanting to write. You know, it's kind of a back and forth there. I want to know a little bit about your writing practice, because it seems like you have probably a time-consuming job, and I'm wondering, like, how do you fit writing into your work life?
I think you just do. I think it's like, as with anything, I'm sure new parents are like, how do I fit in anything? And then you do. Right? Like, it's just like life goes on. The baby requires all of your attention all the time for survival. But then again, you still go to the gym and you still go to your job and you still go do this and that, and you find a way to make it work because this is what life is, right? So I think similarly with writing, it's the thing that feeds me. I know that I couldn't, like, if at my job they were to tell me, you can't write anymore, I would quit.
Mm-hmm.
I can't live a life where I'm not able to do that thing too. So right. You have to understand that both of those things move in tandem, right? So for me, given that's a part of lifeblood for me, it's a part of the oxygen I need to get my body going, I find it time to do it. You know, I think it's always on my mind, and things spark my interest, and I'll write it down. If I'm in a meeting, someone says something, I'm like, oh, that's a bar. I may write a little bit. I'm taking notes and paying attention here. But then the other half of my brain is also like, let me get this down, this skeleton that I'll go investigate later. So I don't necessarily think I have the most structured, like Stephen King is one of my favorite writers. I think he's a master of craft. And I think he's underappreciated in like the halls of this is great literature and craft because of the stuff he writes about. But he's a master at what he does. He talks about the reason he wrote 70 million books, right, is 6 pages a day, right?
Which is it?
That's, I know, right? But it's a very structured approach to writing. I don't think I've ever had that, although I would like to try it out to see if I can move in that way, because it seems like, oh, that makes sense. I could get there. And even with just 6 pages, I can work through the hard stuff, right? Like, I know I can get something and then continue to edit it. So I think I'm more, for me, it's not that structured, but what it is, when an idea comes, I want to chase it until the energy is depleted from it at that moment. So like, if after this call, I just feel inspired, I want to write until like the energy's gone. And then I can set that thing aside and come back to it at a later time to say, okay, now what is I talking about? What editing needs to happen? How do I mold this into the form that will be its final version, right? So I think that's probably most important in terms of process for me, is that chasing the thing until the energy is gone at that moment, because you're not going to remember it later and it's not going to have the same kind of passion and inspiration attached to it if you wait.
Right. No, it sounds like you're very intrinsically motivated and you find the time because it's important to you. I mean, I really enjoy the metaphor of kids, because right now I actually work at like a daycare at a gym. And I will see these parents come in with these little kids. And I'm like, I don't know how they have time to fit that in with their kids, but they do. And it's not always the exact same hour every day, but it's like, I consistently see the same parents with the same kids dropping them off so we can handle them. They can go off and like do whatever. And that's one of the things that feeds me in my writing. Like, I've had some very heavy jobs. I used to do some fundraising, face-to-face fundraising in Washington, D.C. I used to teach high school, where we would talk about like Holden Caulfield for just weeks on end, and existentialism and how cold it is in New York and where do the ducks go and stuff like that. And now I'm taking a break from that. And like, I gotta just blow bubbles all day. And the kids will say the cutest things. Like the other day, one of them, I overheard them saying like, well, I'm going to be the mommy pirate and you be the baby pirate and you're a baby shark and we're all on the ship together. And I'm just like, mommy pirate, baby pirate. Of course. Like,
yeah, that's something.
That's how kids think. They always think in terms of like mommy and baby. Everything has a mommy and a baby involved because that's their world. Like, that's where they came from. So of course there's a mommy pirate and a baby pirate. Just like,
that,
really trying to think back to that.
Working with kids and getting that perspective fuel the questions that you're exploring and answering? Like, how does that show up in your work at all? Of like, that's a different level of connection.
I think when I first started working there, like I wrote one or two poems that I really like about the kids, like listing some of their questions and things like, oh man, I have this one little girl who just always wants to take off her socks. I don't know why. She's just really into bare feet. And so I spent an hour just chasing her around, putting socks on. I'd turn around, she'd take them off. I'd put them on, she'd take them off. And I was thinking like, yes, I have become the master of the social norms. I'm forcing her to wear socks. And then I was thinking about what's it like being a kid and all these restrictions on you and people always telling you what to do and taking away the bubbles and telling you not to throw things, and they forced you to wear socks. And so I wrote a poem about that, about, you know, losing the freedom of childhood but fighting the power and continuing to take off your socks no matter how many times they put them back on. And I still think about that when I'm like with the kids. They'll say something really interesting. They'll do something interesting. I'll write it down. I'll make a mental note about it. But honestly, like sometimes it's just my therapy session. And I walk in and I'm like, I'm not here to do work. I'm at therapy. All of these little five-year-olds are my therapists. And they're just going to help me forget my problems by blowing bubbles at each other, you know, for the next 3 hours. And by the time I leave, I'm just going to feel lighter, and whatever I was working out, maybe in a poem, I can kind of let that go and, you know, go eat candy or go for a walk in the woods and then come back to the heavier stuff later. So I think in some ways, like it's there just to balance me out a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm the interviewer and you're the interviewee. So I should be asking you the questions. I wanted to ask so about Forgive Me, Father. It sounds like you write quite a lot. So I want to know, like, how did this particular book come about? When did you realize that you were writing on a particular subject, or you had enough together to make a chapbook that kind of hangs together this way?
Yeah, I think the actual book came together very fast, but the idea came to me maybe 2018 or 2019 when I was in grad school getting my Master of Poetry. So my time at UEA was the first time in my life where I got to study poetry and do nothing else. You know, like
I'm just
focused on this. And I did that intentionally. I was like, I worked all these jobs in undergrad. I was doing all this other stuff. But here I have this incredible opportunity to not do anything else but focus on poetry. And so I did that and really got deep into the craft. And also, I'm 4,000 miles away from Milwaukee. And from everything happening in the US and from all of my history and everything like that. And so it allowed me to zoom out and examine life and things in a way that you can't when you're in it. Like when you're in direct proximity to whatever that you're dealing with, it's hard to get the bird's eye view. It's hard to analyze things because you're in the moment. But when I'm 4,000 miles away, I finally have the opportunity to look into some of these things in a real way and spend that time with it. And I also have the kind of emotional distance to be a good observer and work on craft around these things. So the idea came to me there, and I maybe had a poem or two that I had written that I, you know, I have all these different folders. I'm like, oh, that's for this book. That's for this book. Like I have a few book ideas, and I just, as the poems come, I'll toss them over. And I was actually working on a different book that was my thesis for UEA. And I had this residency lined up, and I was going to do all these great things. And that was going to be my idea. And then COVID happened and the residency disappeared because federal buildings are all closed. They don't have money anymore. Nobody's doing anything. So that's not happening. And I just get back to the US and I'm back in now because of all this stuff that's gotten canceled because of COVID. I end up back in Milwaukee, which means I'm back in proximity to all these things. And so it felt like a moment of the universe bringing me back to say, you got to find peace with this, whatever that looks like for you. You got to figure it out. And so it's like, cool, I hear you. I don't like it. This feels disrespectful, but okay, like, we're doing this, right? And so I think, and even still, I don't think I was intentionally focused on, I was more focused on like finding the peace for myself than like, I need to write a book out of this. So I wasn't really writing necessarily, but the ideas are being generated because of life experience. And then Black Sunflowers Poetry Press, they had a competition for their kind of introductory slate of poets. And I found out they reached out to me about the opportunity to submit some work. And I was like, all right, like, I don't really have it, but I'm somebody who's like, you give me a deadline. I'm like, that's enough time to do anything. So yes, I don't know what the time frame was, but it was very short. And most of the poems in this book, I wrote over a very intense 12-hour period.
No way.
Not doing anything else. And by the end of it, I'm delirious and don't know how to spell anymore.
That's insane. Although it does remind me, I think, of Cat Stevens for Harold and Maude. No, I'm thinking of Graduate. It was Simon and Garfunkel, like, got commissioned to do The Graduate, and they had like a week to put together all the music for The Graduate. Mm-hmm. And I just think, like, I don't advise that. I know some people can do it. I know it can definitely light that fire under you. You seem to have handled it really, really well. But generally speaking,
it's not a practice that I would advise. But what I would advise is to step into the challenge if it presents itself. Like, if it's your time and if it's your moment, be ready, right? Like, that's just kind of what it is. And if you've already been, so now if I'd never wrote poetry, and I didn't know anything about poetry, it'd be like, I can't do this. But if I just finished my master's degree and I have these scholarships and I've traveled and performed and I've taught and I've done all this stuff, and I already have this, the idea, the ideological framework for the text, and I have a couple of poems to ground me, I know the trajectory, the journey I want to tell, now I can start to slot those poems in. So however many poems I ultimately started with, I don't know, five or whatever, of like, these are the pieces to the journey. Okay, what are the other stories? I've already lived these stories. I know what they are, right? I know the pieces. I now have a grounding in form and craft in new way. So it's like, let me put it down on paper. And it was just this grind. And it was a lot of like sitting on the floor writing, taking time to go for walks through the neighborhood, listening to music and coming back to the text. And then by the end of it, it was like, I don't want to look at it anymore. I'm just going to send it out and to the ether, and whatever happens, happens.
Wow. And did you give yourself like some kind of prompt or structure? Did you say, I know I want these many poems. I want this subject, this subject, this subject, or, you know, tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, I think I knew the journey. And I think it's one day I hope to turn this into a full collection, because I think a chapbook can't hold the full journey, but it's like these pieces of light, because, you know, it's just a book that's really grounded in generational trauma and how you carried it, and this idea of forgiveness at the core. Like, how do you find it? What is it? And also, is it necessary? And so what I wanted to do is, like, you deal with these things and how it follows you throughout life. It shows up, like, this relationship to a father is not just in childhood with a direct relationship to the father. What does it mean when I'm also 4,000 miles away? What does it mean after that, when I'm coming back and I'm moving through life? What does it mean in terms of friendship? What does it mean in terms of romantic relationships? And so I knew the trajectory of, like, let's follow this life journey, and it'll be chopped up into sections. And then it's about sliding in those moments. And it's about finding what are the moments that actually speak to this directly. So I think that's the kind of grounding I had. I don't think I had any other outlining besides that, in terms of maybe, I'm sure I had whatever their, like, page limits were, maybe that I saw that kind of thing and knew what that was. And I think, I mean, we did cutting after, so there's some stuff that didn't make the cut, you know, once they accepted it and then they come back and we talk. But I think it was just that knowing the journey. And I have those few poems that ground me that I can then build things around.
So unfortunately, of course, the listeners may not have read the entire book at this point. Yeah. So they haven't got the benefit of knowing all the titles and all the different pieces. But I know there's one, there's a lot of poems that, and a lot of lines from the poems that, you know, really struck me. And I've been thinking about them today. But there's one poem where the title is, you know, the title of your book is Forgive Me, Father, or Father, Forgive Me. And then the title of the poem is For You Have Sinned. Yeah. So that play on, you know, in the Catholicism, you say, Forgive Me, Father, for I have sinned.
Yeah.
And encountering this poem, it's like, oh, that's a reversal of the expectations. Forgive me, Father, for you have sinned. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, was that one of your kind of foundational five poems that you had already?
No. I think that is one of, if not the last poem I wrote.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the later poems that came about. So that's on the tail end of the creation of this whole thing. Yeah, which is very interesting. So there were poems, let's see, what did I have? I think Home was an early one. Scorched Earth, there were pieces of it. Mm. Snapshots, and maybe On Forgiveness. Those are some of the ones that I had in an early version of Boy Speaks to the River Jordan, which I've been working on for a long time. But no, For You Have Sinned was one of the last ones that came about, even though it's kind of, as you pointed to, it's the kind of crux of everything that I'm talking about. Like, that poem is a part of the foundation of the work in terms of the theory behind the chapbook, but it came very late in process.
That's really fascinating. You know, could you say a little bit about, did you know you had to write that? What was that like, generating that one?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I knew I had to write it. Mm-hmm. But I definitely had to write it in terms of how it grounds the text of, like, taking me on this journey. And here's here's the beginning. Right. And so we go through all this of, like, I'm grappling with this stuff throughout life. What's the genesis of all that? It's this idea of learning how, like, so young, we treat boys as if they need to be men. So this is a story about being at five and sustaining an injury and then being told to, like, be a man. And it's like, okay, I'm five. I now know how to be a man, but what about being a boy? I know nothing about that. And throughout my childhood, didn't learn about it. Didn't have the opportunity or the space or the grace to be a boy. And then, so then that is the crux of, now you live a life as that. You never got to be soft. You never got to get in touch with the tender side of your humanity. And it's a shame that we don't allow people that space. So I think, didn't know I had to write it, but definitely needed to write it. And it's one of those poems that really, like, the book couldn't really exist without that poem and without investigating that memory, I think, in a real way. And it took me a while to write it too, because I think it's a deceptively simple poem, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, I want it to be, it's just this memory, right? It's a kid running Bust his knee open on the sidewalk. Very simple, basic thing. And how do you bring it in to this much larger philosophical point that it gets? So it was that one took me a little bit, I think, to get right.
I'm really glad, actually, for the two poems that you read at the beginning here, which I am going to ask you about, the one that ends with, like, you know, make sure he knows that he is loved.
Yeah.
You know, that one just definitely had me like clutching at my heart when I was reading it.
Yeah.
And it's such a, deceptively simple message, but it brings attention to the fact that not everyone really gets that message when they're younger. And we all still need to hear it. Everyone needs to hear it. And especially, you know, like the speaker of the poem comes to that conclusion. So I think this is a good segue to ask about the two poems that you read at the beginning. Which one of them came easily? And then which one was more of a challenge?
Yeah, so Stretch Marks was the one that came easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because it's that thing that, truthfully, I think all men deal with. It's that at the core of like this idea of being made to be hard, and that's supposed to be the traditional role of a man. And as if you can't have multiple sides and still provide and still do your job and still take care of your kids and still love, like everything has to be so militant and distant and hard. And I think the vehicle through which was Stretch Marks, which is typically associated with women, and men definitely don't talk about stretch marks on their body. And it's evidence of like this softer thing and this form of body, and that being the vehicle through which to explore, like, yo, let the kid know it was okay. Like, nobody ever told him that. Mm-hmm. Like, what does it mean? You see these stretch marks, like, it's okay, man. You're a little pudgy or whatever. It's like, you're still loved. That doesn't change the fact that, you know what I mean? Like, you're a boy, we still love you. Go play, go eat, whatever it is. We see that and it's okay. Follow those lines to find the love. And so I thought that was a great entry point to like have that conversation and also give people permission. Like, yo, it really is okay. Like, bodies change, they morph and conform as you grow and as you bulk up and lose weight or whatever the thing may be. It's just a marker of life, you know?
And I mean, first of all, that's lovely. And, I want to ask you a little bit more about that, but also the title Stretch Marks. I remember reading that and then going back to read the title and going, stretch marks we usually associate with women, especially during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. You know, your body stretches out, you have all these stretch marks afterwards. So I was thinking of it as, you know, consciously talking about kind of what we associate with women, but also I was thinking stretching like, maybe it's a stretch at first, if you've been taught all this time to, you know, kind of shut down your feelings and now to open up and be more emotional and be more, you know, verbally affectionate, like that's a stretch. So like, these are the marks of stretching in that, you know, more positive way, I guess. But yeah, that was a really thought-provoking title.
Yeah, I'm glad. And it is also that, like subconsciously that stretching too. I mean, even the physical embodiment of stretch marks on a man are in a way that stretching, right? Like to be open about them or to be visible with them is stretching yourself to kind of move into the tender. And it opens you up for a level of vulnerability that you're not often allowed to have.
I'm going to be honest here. Up until this point, I didn't even know that men could get stretch marks. So that's a little.
There you go. Look, I did. Yeah, I grew up with them on my arm. I mean, I think at this point you can't see them. It's all tattoos and everything. But I remember having them on my arms growing up and being very insecure about them. And like, because they were like evidence of me being overweight and all these things. And I couldn't, when I was a kid, I wasn't an athletic kid growing up, like through elementary, middle school, and everything like that. And like, I remember a moment, I'm sure I talk about it in the book, of like, I didn't even know how to exercise as a kid.
Mm.
I remember transitioning, I think from eighth grade going into high school, I remember asking my brother point blank, like, how do I do a push-up? Like, I had no idea. I'm like, what are the physics behind like a push-up? And so for me, it's again, the stretch marks were evidence of like, that wasn't me, but that's the ideal that we set aside for boys, right? Like when we're grown up, it's like, all right, I can't have my little junior. He's going to get into baseball, football, basketball. We're going to be throwing a pigskin, whatever. My daughter, I'll give her the dolls and she may go to dance or whatever. But the boy, You know what I mean? And I'm not saying it's right, but it is what it is, what it's been. And it's been restrictive in that way, where we have this ideal and that we impose on folks, and we don't think about, well, what are we stripping from them by forcing them to do this? Like, what are we, when we force them to go, like, my idea of you is this, but if it doesn't match up, then what is that doing? What's the dissonance doing to that kid? Or when, what are we doing when we don't allow them to cry? They grow up and don't know how to express emotions. And the only emotion that men have traditionally been allowed to have is anger.
Yeah.
And what does that turn into, right? It turns in, there's violence that's enacted upon the family as a result of that, right? So this is that, the way that it travels throughout your life and follows you on your life journey and how it manifests in unhealthy ways. And for, like, why do we want that ideal versus, like, yeah, let the little boy cry and then talk through it. Let him be okay. He'll grow up, be fine. I promise you it'll be okay, right? He can still be a man, even having those tenderness, because we all do.
So this is kind of a more complicated subject. It sounds like this poem came easily, but I'm really curious, like, what was your journey to discovering that, to discovering, like, it is okay for men to express feelings and be more loving? I know we only have so much time here, so I don't know if you can summarize it in a short way, but, you know, do you have kind of a shorter elevator pitch?
Right, yeah. Maybe I should at this point. I haven't written the book, but I think slowly is how it came to be. I even think about, like, to my closest friends now, people I've known at this point for over 10 years, when we were going through undergrad together, we didn't talk about this stuff. We weren't vulnerable with each other. And it wasn't until either later in undergrad or after that we really started to open up. And even one of my closest friends, he got married in the past couple of years. And I remember after his wedding or at his bachelor party, we were talking about some of our history. And he told me something about, like, this conflict we had way back that he thought it put distance between us, but we never talked about it. And so on his end, for years, he thought that our relationship wasn't at the same level. We were still friends, but we weren't, like, best friends. And just simply because we didn't have the space to sit down and talk, like, yo, this is how I felt about this. Like, I just wanted to talk to you because it didn't sit right with me, or, like, and then just work through it and be like, okay, we're good. And so much of my life was that, because I learned very young that you can't do that as a boy. Like, I cry, I get in trouble. I'm castigated, I'm yelled at, whatever. So you learn to put the armor on and you learn to put the mask on. And so I moved through the world, even though internally I was a crying kid. I was I cried all the time. I was a super sensitive kid. But as I grew, I became more and more hard. And so I got the screw face on, I'm, you know, the mug, I'm walking through the world, and I increasingly start to embody those things until you become hard. And then I get older and I'm in college and I'm like, I have to rediscover the tenderness. Yeah. And so it's this journey of looking back. And then also, I think eventually just developing in those friendships and with my brothers in particular, just opening up to have those conversations. So it's just a slow thing where over time you start to ask those questions or express that emotion to your male friends. And then you all learn by doing, of like, how do we really hold space for each other? How do we talk? How do we learn it's okay? And I think it helps to also have a diversity of friends. Like, I have friends who are all different types of men. And like, learning to give each other space in that regard. So I think the simplest answer is just a slow process of rediscovery. And I intentionally use the word rediscovery because we all have that in us. You know what I mean? We just, it's forced out of so many of us early.
Yeah. No, it sounds like it was sort of a seed that was already planted in you, or, like, you know, it is you, it is the seed of your personality and your way of being in the world. And you covered it up and then had to learn how to uncover it again. I have a degree in psychology of creativity, so I'm always kind of very interested in the way the human mind changes and how it gets from point A to point B, and how did it get there and how do you get it back, or, you know, how do we create these changes in ourselves and others, and, you know, hopefully positive changes too, because a lot of the changes people go through can kind of make them worse for the wear, let's say. So that's a great discussion of stretch marks, and thank you for that. I want to know now about the more difficult poem.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, it's
Boy Speaks to the River Jordan.
Yeah. So I want to know more about the difficult poem, Boy Speaks to the River Jordan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I read, what I read was actually the first draft of the poem. And mm-hmm. the reason I did that is because this to get to the final, which I wouldn't have had time to read, it takes like 10 minutes to actually read it because it's about a 5-6 page poem, the longest thing I've ever written. But I read the first draft because to emphasize the journey that it went
through.
Like the first draft came together very quickly on the whim of, in my master course for one of our workshops, they told us to bring something in that needed editing. And the only stuff I had was old work that I didn't care about. Like I knew if you edit it, it'd be like, so what? I'm not gonna ever put it out. So I was like, oh, I need something that I wanna engage with moving forward. So I wrote this really quickly. And then I had to go run to catch the bus to get to the campus, right? and then it was this journey of trying to get feedback in workshop and then talking to some of the people in the class that I got closest to and who really took deep dives into the work and trying to figure out, okay, here's the skeleton of it. I know what I'm talking about is this son talking to his mom and his mom being the River Jordan, which is the source of life and foundation in scripture. So it's like this coming home, this rejuvenation, this cleanse. Now, how do I embody that? The next step was, what is the form? Mm-hmm. Is there a way for the form? Because it's just a giant block of text initially. So is there a way for the form to augment the content? And that took me on a journey, and I had did a presentation on, or I led a workshop on The Glass Essay by Ann Carson. And that's a tremendous long form poem. And by that point in life, I hadn't read too many, but I learned a ton from that and went through reading and figured out, how do you take readers on a journey for like a poem that is so long? And so, okay, I started to pick out pieces of that understanding. And then, okay, at the core of this piece is love. And what's the form that's great for that is the sonnet, right? The traditional, the OG poetic form, which is the sonnet. And so then it's like slowly putting it all together, and it turned into this heroic crown of sonnets, which is this interconnected chain of 15 sonnets that I think the last line of one is the first line of the other, and then all the lines mm-hmm. come back in the last sonnet, and there's all this conventions of the sonnet still work. So it's this incredibly complex puzzle that took so long. I remember going on a mini writer's retreat. A friend of mine was supposed to come over to London. She had a hotel room and she couldn't make it. And she was like, you want the room? And I was like, I guess. I was living I was probably in Norwich at the time, which is like 90 minutes from London. I was like, great, I'll just use it as a mini retreat. So I remember spending time a few days in London, just in this hotel room and buying food for the room. Cause I'm just like, I'm just in the room writing, trying to figure out this poem to get it to a final form. So this was one that took, I mean, you know, from inception to finalizing, I don't know, that's many, many, many months working on this and stepping away and coming back, just because I'd never written a poem this long before. I'd never written a poem as complicated and probably never written something as close to my heart, you know, all those things together. And I knew I wanted it to be the last part of the book, which also is like, I needed to take this very seriously because I always had early on, I had the idea that there's this thing that happens with relationship to parents where you're like, you can be feeling terrible. You have all this, you let out, I have 45 minutes of venting to do to you. Your parents can come back to you with like a sentence and it's all good. And so I wanted it to be this conversational thing that's happening and for the mom to be the grounding of that, of like the healing force and the one that whatever your piece is, they're a part of that and they help you find that. And that's why this, even though the book is about a relationship between son and father, it ends son and mom to take you on that journey. So yeah, all of that. It was a long process, really hard to get right. And now I'm proud of my mom. She cried when she read it. So I think I did all I needed to do, you know.
That's wonderful. And so listeners, first of all, definitely get the book and read the entirety of the poem. You started reading it and I thought, is he going to read that 6-page long poem at the end? Okay, well, we've got the time. Why not? And then you stopped it earlier. Yeah. And I thought, oh, he just read a part of the poem. You know, that is a really incredible piece. And yeah, I had noticed that the book, the title of the book is about the father. And most of the poems, I think, you know, directly reference the father and, you know, what it is to be growing up as a male in the world today. And so when we did get to the mother, and then it was this very, very long poem, like it was a significant turn in terms of topic. But I felt like also there was this turn of the energy, like, you know, I don't know, there was something more nurturing about it, I think. And then ending the whole book on home, because there's a poem earlier that says, like, home is where I have to escape from in order to go right. And then coming back and, like, you know, I'm heading home. But I got the sense it was more of, like, you know, a significantly spiritual home, you know, emotional home, as opposed to like a literal space. And I also have to admit, I wasn't 100% sure if the mother was still alive in the poem, because there's this repetition about those gone too soon. And I wasn't entirely sure if that was referring to a mother that's still here or a mother that's, like, you know, kind of omnipresent and can see everything. So glad to get that clarified. I mean, of course, assuming that you are the speaker, which may not be the case.
But that's also, I've never had anybody say that before, but it's an interesting wrinkle to add to the poem, because in my interpretation, the mom is very much alive. But I think in calling the mom the River Jordan, and the significance placed upon the mom, and also she's not a real person per se. It's like this larger than life thing. What is the mom? Who is the mom really when you're coming to her with your problems and you need peace, right? Well, who is the mom when you're struggling and you need grace? Yeah. It's not like she's not human mom, even though she is literally human mom, but that's not really who you're talking to at that. You know, like a parent at the beginning talked about new parents, and like the baby 100% relies on you for their survival. So you're not just mom and dad, you're superhero. Right? You're the closest thing to that embodiment. So in some ways, though the mother is alive, I think is related to in an almost mythical way, or in this sense, it's like very much grounded in scripture and faith, and like how the River Jordan has been foundational for these peoples for so long. So, yeah, it's interesting.
No, that's a really fascinating topic. And I'm curious, like, do you show your mother a lot of your writing when you're writing it? Do you know she's going to read it? Or how does that factor in when you're writing a poem that references mother?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I don't think like poetry is really my mom's thing. You know what I mean? Not like out here reading poets like that. But so I didn't really, in the original conception, didn't really think about like showing it to her. Like,
okay,
you needed to read it. I think but in finishing the book, she's one of the people I knew I wanted to give one of the copies that I had to, you know, like the people who are closest to me and most important to me. And so I gave it to her, really having no idea what to expect, how she would take it, or if she would just be like, I don't know, just talking about, like, you know what I mean? I had no idea, because that's not really, she's not really grounded in poetry. It's not an art form that she really engages with. And so like there's a part of me being a poet and a part of my life as a writer and a creator that's a bit mystical to her, you know, like it's just, like that's great. I support it. I love seeing little articles or whatever, but I don't really know what's going on over there. So I didn't really know how she would react to it, but I'm happy that it touched her and for whatever reason that it really resonated with her.
Yeah, I this is a complicated thing for me as well. And I'm sure for a lot of poets. In fact, I'll give a shout out. There's a podcast called If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. And a lot of poets that I know have been interviewed on this podcast to write about or to talk about poems written either about their own mothers or poems written about motherhood and what it's like to be a mother. So, I mean, clearly it's a very universal topic a lot of poets think about. And I was writing some poems about my family, not thinking they would ever see them. Then at one point I realized like they might become a book, and then my parents are definitely going to want to come and come to a book launch and read it, and I had to write a poem like explaining to my mother that the word mother doesn't necessarily refer to her. You know, because there are some times in the poem where maybe you are consciously writing about something that is rooted in something that maybe happened with your real mother, but then it's poetry and it can become metaphorical and it can become symbolic. And pretty soon you're writing about something and it has nothing to do with a literal event or what have you. And so I had to write this long poem, like, just so you know, in the book, when I say mother, I could mean mother, but I could also mean ocean. I could also mean, you know, and just like all these other metaphors and how mother is a metaphor for all these other things and all these other things become metaphors for your mother. And after that, I felt kind of safe. I was like, "Phew, I've stated it. She understands. If there's a poem in here she doesn't like, she knows it's not about her. If other people read this, they're not gonna, you know, have the wrong opinion about her either." So I think that's just like, that's very brave to write a poem that references any mother and then show it to them, the real one.
So this whole thing speaks to this larger conversation about your responsibility to these people that you write about. There's a good friend of mine who's a brilliant writer, Ajahnay Dawkins, who, well, she's married now, so she might have a different last name. So my bad, Ajahnay. But she's a brilliant writer. And I remember her talking once about like her young self as a writer versus now and how she was kind of irresponsible with the way she wrote about people. Because it's almost, you're just focused on writing. And from your perspective, here's the truth, whatever the thing may be. And you're not necessarily thinking about, well, is this their perspective or how do they feel? How do they take it? How did they feel with themselves being displayed in some version to the world? All these things. So like this idea of what's your responsibility to the other people that you write about in your text. And I think everybody will have to figure that out for themselves. But what do you do? Some people it's like, I need the blessing before this ever goes to publication. Other people are just like, I just want to let you know I'm talking about you in the text. Other people, you let them discover it on their own. For everybody, it's their own thing. But I do think it's important to think about and for you to develop your own kind of compass, your own moral compass for how you engage with other folks and when you're writing about them, because we all pull them into our work in some degree. And I think it is what is irresponsible is not knowing how you are choosing to engage with those other folks that you're writing about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really another one of those universal problems in poetry too, is like, and I feel like I know some writers who have written beautiful, amazing, hard-hitting, wonderful things. And then they say, sorry, I know you like it, but I can't publish this because I don't ever want XYZ to see this. And I let them know, you know, this is something that you can figure out for yourself. I'm not going to force anything on you. Obviously, I can't. You know, there's ways to get around it. Like you can change names. You can write under a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. You can change your brother to your cousin. You can change your mother to your aunt. You know, you can do all kinds of things to maybe soften the blow or disguise or just like assume your relatives never are going to read the poem and don't tell them. And you'll probably be safe for like most of your life, unless you have relatives who are constantly like, you know, reading obscure journals where you're getting published. Or on your Facebook feed. By the way, if you don't know this, listeners, you can actually like set your settings for every post you make. So if you want to shout out to your writer friends, hey, I got this poem about so-and-so published, you can block them so they can't see it.
This is true.
Just trying to be helpful out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think everyone has to figure it out for themselves. I value poetry. I love poetry. I don't want anyone to ruin their personal connections over publishing a poem just because it's really, you know, because I think it's really good. So yeah, it sounds like you've kind of found that medium for yourself.
Yeah, I think so. I think with this book, it was interesting because I think like I don't have a relationship with my father. And so it's like, I don't have a window to be like, hey, Pops, how do you feel about, like, here's my perspective on our relationship. What do you think? Or how do I, should I revise based on that? So, but I also think that's a part of the journey too, of like, what do you do when, like, how do you seek forgiveness when you can't talk to the person and find peace with the situation, when it's all one-sided? What does forgiveness mean when the bridge is still burning? Right? Those kind of things, like, how do you grapple with it? So the book is definitely written from that perspective as well. It's a journey where you're like, what is the utility of forgiveness, or what does it look like for you when the door is closed towards the coming together, right? And that healing can't happen in the way that we traditionally think about healing, then what do you do? And so it was an interesting perspective in terms of this book, in terms of that moral compass of how do you engage with some folks. But I think you make do and understand that that's where it's coming from. It makes me think a lot about, like, so much of the text we read historically, we're like, oh, that's a good perspective into these people, when realistically it's like, oh, this is a good perspective into how the author saw these people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's what it is. And for me, this is objective truth, but also it's coming from how I saw it. And if my father were to write a book of poetry, it would be a different thing. I would be like, he's wrong, but it's a different thing. So it's also just understanding, part of reading poetry and engaging with it is understanding speaker, right? And really with any writing, understanding speaker and how can I trust the speaker, and understanding what angle I'm approaching whatever topic from. So folks who read this book also should understand that too, of coming from the person who's trying to find that forgiveness and going on that journey.
Do you feel like the book was cathartic in that way? And follow-up question, do you feel like you're done with this topic, or are you going to keep writing these poems about the bridge that's still burning?
I don't think the book was cathartic, no.
Okay.
Because I think for me, it was just, the book just is. Like, this is just what happened. I'm just writing. So it wasn't, like, people tell me a lot of how vulnerable the book is, and I never once thought of it in those terms in creating the book. And so, like, for me, it's not. It's just like, no, it's just life. I just wrote the thing. And so it wasn't cathartic for me in that way. Do I think I'll still write? Yeah, because I want to turn this into a full collection. Like, the journey. So this is like, what, I don't know, 25, 30 pages, but there's a good 90 to 100 so I have all the ideas for it to transform it. And then I probably will be done to some degree. But I think these are also themes that you continue to explore, because they made me who I am, and they're still within me. And also now, as I get older too, I think about how they're within other people who are younger than me, right? Again, me being in a teaching position, or me being somebody who other folks see as successful, what is my responsibility to these other young men coming up? And as we're giving them space and giving them permission to be whole human beings.
Yeah.
And exploring it in my writing as well. I want somebody to look at this and realize, like, it's okay to have stretch marks. It's okay to cry. You can be multifaceted as a human being. You can have all those things. I'm a huge fight fan. There's a fighter, middleweight champion of the world in the UFC, Israel Adesanya. And he's a man, I mean, he's ran through that division. He'll be in the Hall of Fame when he retires. But he also is a man who's like, paints his nails and gets pedicures and all these things, and who is open about the times when he cries and does all this. And so that is like, just show he has a multifaceted, his literal job is beating people up for money.
Yeah.
But he's also does all these things traditionally associated with women and femininity. Right. So there's
I just love that.
and the reason it's important is not to say that, like, aggression or violence is what makes you a man, but we've heralded those things of, like, toughness of being a man. So there's no way you can discount him as being a man, and he has his fingernails painted. So now you have to deal with that and realize, oh, if this is also a man, then the definition of man is more expansive than we've been led on to believe.
Yeah.
And I think that's the space I want young boys to be in. And really, to get all man, but if we're talking about passing things down, I want them to know that the spectrum is wider, right? It's okay. There's more to you, and there's more that you can explore. There's more that you can be comfortable in order to be your full self.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like this is such a hot topic right now because, and someone pointed this out on NPR, I'm really bad about references. I'll remember an idea and completely forget who said it. But, someone was talking about how for a long time, like, women have had more discussion around changing gender roles for women. We've had a lot of people who stood up and said, like, I want to be, Amelia Earhart. I want to go and fly these airplanes. And the fact that I'm a woman, it's not going to stop me. And all these messages to women, like, you can do all the things that you weren't encouraged to do before, but we haven't had a whole lot of visibility with men talking about their possibility for changing roles. Like, we haven't had a whole lot of discussion about men standing up and saying it's okay to cry. I mean, I think we see more of it now, hopefully. Of course, we also get a lot of backlash on both, you know, but I think that's really important. And I know nothing about fighters, but I'm really grateful for this this guy you mentioned to do that openly, because we need that.
For sure. Absolutely, we do. And I think it's, you know, when we talk about kind of the limitations of men having been given that space, so much of that softness, too, when it hasn't given space, it's just been attacked. I think about historically in terms of Black liberation movements, James Baldwin is a titan in terms of the things he's done for Black folks. But Eldridge Cleaver, who was a Black Panther and a writer, and he was in prison and he writing about all these different topics and discovering and becoming in himself. He also had a chapter or this letter where he attacked James Baldwin as being a queer man and how this is like he's now a shield of the white man and all this stuff because of his queer identity. Right. So we associate this softness with queerness, with that can't be a man.
Yeah.
Right? And like it's this line that we paint, and it's happened so much in terms of, I speak specifically from Black liberation movements because that's where I'm grounded. And like, that just makes no sense. How can you, that James Baldwin is some shill of white folks because he's a queer man and queerness is not innate to Black people or whatever the thing Eldridge Cleaver is believing, as opposed to, no, he just also is queer. He just likes men too, right? That doesn't discount any of his work that he did for Black people. It doesn't make his stories less impactful. It doesn't make his thoughts and his ideology less forward thinking. It doesn't make it less concrete of a vision for the freedom of a people, right? But so much of that, and even the queer folks who helped lead the civil rights movement were having to work in the background because otherwise people wouldn't be to accept it in the same way. And so when we do give space for this, it's often attacked in ways and discounting, like we try to cover up the fact that queer people have been doing this stuff because we don't associate that with manhood and masculinity. But it's like, no, they, you know, just the same as me. It's just a different kind. Like, it's just, and that just is what it is. And like, it should be okay. And that should be fine. And we should move through the world, whatever your definition and conception of a man is, if that works for you and the people in your life, you're not harming others, then fine. You know, there's untold avenues and caves and deep dives into what a man can be that haven't been discovered yet.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just thinking about Whitman, because I'm always thinking about Whitman, but like I contain multitudes, you know, we all contain multitudes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And we should. And again, going back to that idea of the Renaissance man too, it's like, or Renaissance person, you know, like we don't really know. And I'm thinking Hamlet now, like, oh, what a piece of work is man or woman. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty and form and movement, how express and admirable in action, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god, the paragon amid the animals, the beauty of the world. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? You know, it's like the idea is that human beings can be the paragon of animals. They can have the apprehension or the comprehension of a god. And you're supposed to be developing all of that, not... not sitting there and saying, I'm the world's greatest specialist in filing medical documents. You know, you're supposed to express all the different parts of yourself and strengthen them and grow and know yourself and to thine own self be true. You know, so I think that's a lot of what your poetry is speaking about. I want to circle back to something you said a moment ago about how you're not consciously aiming at vulnerability in your poems. Can you say a little bit more about what that is, what you mean about that?
Well, I don't know if I have a way to explain it in a succinct way or in a way that folks understand, but going through the process of this book, again, that term never crossed my mind. It never felt like vulnerability to me. It felt like this is just the truth of what happened in the situation and the truth. And like, this is the reality of one way that the oppressive limitations on masculinity manifest, right? Mm-hmm. This journey that goes on. And the complicated nuances of what masculinity is. Like there are things, I think there's a trap that happens where the exhibition or exhibiting certain aspects of femininity means that you are no longer masculine. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's not true at all, right? And that we don't talk about the overlays between the two, and we don't talk about, again, the full embodiment of like how these things make somebody a human. All of us have these things within us. And even if you skew more towards one or the other, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not this thing. So for mm-hmm. me, it was just, this is just the truth of the limitations that were imposed and the journey of how do you deal with it and how do you move through the world.
Yeah.
And it was more about, for me, I think it was more about capturing those things and probably more about how does the craft help me capture it and making sure it's that I'm capturing that truth on paper as opposed to feeling like or thinking that, oh, I'm exposing something to the world here. And this is like something intimate that other people will engage with. It just didn't feel like that for me. And maybe that's, you know, just a product of me having been a writer and performer for so long that I've gotten past that point. But I think more so it was just, I think I was just in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm like thinking about language choices here. So like the difference between capturing something versus exposing something, because they are kind of, it's a paradox, right? When you write something, you have captured it, you've given it a physical corporeal presence, you know, the ink on the paper, the document on your laptop, you print it out, it's there, it's got a physical presence, you've captured it. But also it is exposure too, which is now I've made it visible for other people. Before, was hiding like in the forest of my mind. It was like ducking between the trees of my conscious and unconscious. And then you put it out on paper and it's like, no, everyone can see it now. Mm-hmm. You know, figuratively speaking. And when we use the term vulnerability, I mean, really what that means is like, you know, able to be hurt. And it seems like at this point you're talking about these are the things that happen with a little bit more dispassion. Like it's not going to hurt you if people read it. It's not going to hurt you if you read it or you admit to it.
Yeah, I think that actually makes me think. I think the reason that it hasn't manifested vulnerability for me is because of having found the peace of like,
yeah,
this happened. But now I'm at a point like I'm vulnerable with my friends and my brothers. I'm very comfortable and confident in who I am. It's like, you know, I'm pretty bulletproof in terms of my own masculinity and my who I am as a person. You know, I move how I move and it is what it is. So I think that's a big part of it, of having gone through the journey.
Yeah.
And where I'm not like I don't have vulnerabilities around this thing. So therefore it didn't manifest as being vulnerable for me.
Right. You know, that's, this is putting me in mind of something too, like, that I think I experienced when I heard Sherman Alexie read his book, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And then also I reference this book all the time, but Writing is a Way of Healing, by Louise DeSalvo, one of my favorite books. And she talks about, you know, writing and like getting some distance from things and like shouldn't necessarily go out and read something, and you don't necessarily have to explore it if you're not ready. You know, if you need to like process it more before you share it with the world, take your time and do that. And I remember Sherman Alexie, when his book, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, came out, I got to hear him read it live. And it's about both of his parents dying and a lot of the stuff that came up for him writing about his childhood and everything. And he's a very funny guy. And he would read like from the first parts of his book, which are these moments of his childhood, and he would laugh and he'd be having a good time with the audience. He'd get to the end where there's the chapters about his parents dying and like he was just in tears. And if you get the audio book, which I recommend you do, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful book and it's a wonderful presentation, but you can hear it even in the audio recording. When he gets to the end of the book, he is significantly having trouble reading these certain passages. And I think he, at the end of his tour, said something like he cut his tour short and he basically just said like, look, I'm not ready to go out reading these things.
Yeah.
I got to have some more space between even the writing of it and having it published. And like, you know, I still need more space before I can go out there and be present with this on stage. And I think that's such a, you know, such an important thing for writers to know, is that it's okay to take your time, and maybe you shouldn't write about something until you've done a little bit of healing around it. Is this something that comes up in your workshops when you're teaching other people about writing? Have you ever had to tell someone, you know, don't write about this topic right now?
No, I haven't, but it's a very interesting conversation, because I think that there is no right or wrong. It's about not necessarily don't write about this. Like, people shouldn't write about something while they're still processing. It's more like, figure out for you what makes sense. Because I think there's also something powerful about capturing the emotions as you're experiencing them. There's a different level of viscera that will come from if you're in the moment and I'm, you know, doing it live, so to speak, than if I have some distance to process it. And then the way that I process it would mean I'm writing about it differently than if I'm living it in the same way. So there's utility for both. But I think what writers should understand is you don't have to martyr yourself to be a writer. And I think that there is an element where it can feel like that, that you have to do that to talk about something, to capture the emotion. Because I'm somebody who definitely thinks vulnerability wins. And that's the way. And like, that's how you get to the core of the human experience. But that does not mean that you have to flog yourself to do that. So it's you cannot write about this. Like, you cannot choose to do this as you're living it. You can also choose to never write about it. You can choose to write about it and keep it private. There's so many ways to approach it. Just figure out what is healthy for you and then block out all the rest. It doesn't matter what your favorite writer did. It doesn't matter what my process is. You write for you. Take what you need from people, throw away the rest to create your own praxis. And so that's something I would, especially as somebody who came from spoken word spaces, I think there's a real problem with young folks feeling like they do have to martyr themselves to get tens on the scoreboard or win competitions or be a champion at Brave New Voices or something. And then there's no aftercare either, right? It's just like these kids come, they tell this story about this assault that happened or this, their parents leaving or whatever, a loss. And then they go back to sit down in their seats and people go, you know, party afterwards or whatever. And that's what's rewarded. But I think we need to have a better system of telling folks, of caring for like each other as we go through these spaces. Like, you don't have to martyr yourself to be an accomplished writer.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the thing that it comes up for me a lot, because I tend to write nature poems about, look, there's a bee in the flower. And like, you know, the world can be falling around behind me. There can be an apocalypse behind me, but like, that's been done before. Let's talk about the bees and the flower, right? You know, because that's, I don't know, that's where my attention goes. That's what I want to focus on today or whatever. And I often get critique in workshop, like, where's your pain? What's at stake? Like, you know, and so I feel sometimes, not that those aren't valid, you know, you absolutely need to have something at stake, even if you are just looking at the bees, you absolutely do need to have something, some dynamic to throw in there. But I also do feel like there's sort of this competition of tragedy competition, you know, like who's got the worst story and that's going to make the best writing. And, you know, I do worry. I worry that that gives people the wrong impression. Some people think I can't be a good writer unless something bad happens to me, or because something bad hasn't happened to me, I'm not allowed to tell my story. My story isn't important. I'm wondering, like, what you tell writers you work with about, you know, delving into the difficult parts of their past. And do you encourage other writers, like, don't aim for your vulnerability, or how do you deal with that with your students?
You know what I would, there was this Twitter thread some years ago at this point, I think there was somebody who asked Dinesh Smith, I forget the conversation about pain or something. They asked, like, they responded that's not what makes you a writer. And the person responded something like, well, then what does? As if, of course, that's what makes you a poet. And Dinesh responded that it's your attention to craft. It's your, like, your studying. It's your intentionality within the work. It's all these other things. You know, the pain can be a part of the informing the content, but that's not what makes you a writer. And so that's the message that I would want to send off to folks who, when they're thinking about exploring the pain, I wouldn't tell somebody to go into it or to stay away from it either way. That's for them to decide. It's more about just know that's not what makes you a writer. And that's not what makes this a poem. That's not what makes this a story, right? Like, it doesn't have to be those things. There could be utility in exploring that. There could be utility in exploring the pain for you and for your readers. There could also be just utility in saying, man, the way the wind is whistling through these trees right now is something else, right? Like, as I listen to it, that also is valid because that's an experience in the world. And we talk about folks like Whitman, who is just like, boy, these country days are something. Like, that's just, and these are brilliant poems that everybody loves and have stood the test of time. So there's something, it doesn't always have to be like, for some reason that just popped in my head. It doesn't always have to be the Uncle Ben story with Spider-Man.
Yeah. Right?
Like, everything doesn't have to be, man, I lost my uncle and this tragedy set me off into this life story. Maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's just like, yo, I saw a really attractive person today and this beautiful woman was sitting on a bench in the park. And that is my whole experience of the park today, just like human beauty and admiring that. Ain't nothing bad happened. It was cool.
Yeah.
I read the newspaper. She sat there, read a book. She left, probably went to work. I don't know. And then that's it. Like, you know, like that's, I think just telling them that, like, it doesn't have to be tragedy. It doesn't have to be pain. It doesn't have to be darkness to get you to where you need to go. And for you to, again, trust yourself and how you engage with that and find a healthy way for you to engage with it and do it for you. I'm very much of the camp that as a writer, write for you.
Yeah.
Write what you like. Right. Don't try to anticipate. Don't be like, oh, yeah, Tresh is going to love this. She's not. If I do that, that's not how I get her to, you know, just write your truth.
Yeah.
And the authenticity of your work is what will attract the world to it. And just focus on it and also engage with it in the healthy way. Don't say, I want to win this prize. So I got to, you know, rip apart my heart and get deep into this because that's what's being awarded. The authenticity will get you there.
Yeah, I think that's really sage advice too. And like, there's actually some studies in the psychology of creativity about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. So like scientists, if they're given prize money as an incentive, you know, invent an airplane, whoever does it first gets this prize, that works for them. Whereas poets, it's just the exact opposite. Like if you are writing a poem because you're trying to win a prize, you're actually going to write worse work because you're thinking so much about how to please someone else that you're not being authentic. I do know people who disagree with me on that. They say that they're very, this is a pretty good example. You wanted to write something for Black Sunflower Press and put the gas in the tank and hit full steam ahead to mix some metaphors there. And you were able to write something pretty spectacular. Actually, I want to ask you about that. When you knew that you wanted to create this in such a short amount of time, were you concerned about other people if they would like it? Or did you have any anxiety about like turning in something that was less than? Can you say how you dealt with that pressure?
By not thinking about it. Like, okay. I think truthfully, it was, okay, here's an opportunity. I've wanted to publish a book. I think by that point, I had told myself that in 2020, I would publish a book. And so it'd either be through a press or it'd be self-published. And so it was just like, I'm gonna do it, here's the opportunity. I'm gonna throw my hat in the ring and then walk away. What happens, happens. And it's like that feeling of you put it out into the world and then move on. And I think also I've developed in life through opportunity, aside from art, the feeling of like, if they want me, they want me. If they don't, it's not a fit.
Yeah.
And that's fun. You know, like jobs, scholarships, opportunities, whatever it may be. I was fortunate to develop that mentality when I was younger. And that's gotten me through it, where it's just like, I know what I offer. I know what I bring. I'm very confident in my writing. If it's a no from Black Sunflowers Press, then it's just like, it wasn't a fit. They're lost.
Yeah.
And I'll go do something else with it. And so I don't think I just didn't internalize pressure. It's just like, let me just create this thing, throw it at him, and then move on.
That is fantastic. I hope everyone gets to develop that kind of mindset because I advocate for that a lot in workshops. I advocate that for myself as well. But having it and being able, you know, knowing that's the ideal mindset, being able to like really enter into it, really take those voices that say, oh, I hope they like me, and like just shut them out. That can take quite a lot of practice, discipline.
Well, I think you're right. And it's also not a perfect process. It's not like you develop it and you never care about anything ever again. That's not the reality. But I think one way to get into that mindset is to think about what's your goal. And then think about what are the different pathways to get there, which means one of them is submitting this book to Black Sunflowers Poetry Press. That's the door. If they shut the door, what's the window look like?
Yeah.
If they close the window, do I have a shovel? Because, you know, basements, foundation may be a little rickety. I may be, you know, maybe it's an unfinished basement. I get down there. Whatever. Just think about it in that sense. I think that's one way to help. If just like, I don't get to my goal, right? One way or another. So if one thing, if one door closes, then there's something else for you to get there. And if you keep that, it doesn't feel like an end to whatever it is you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, that is really useful. And it's great that you kind of had that in mind. You were going to work on the book regardless. And if, you know, you had a deadline to meet for this one, that kind of put the pressure on, but you were going to finish it anyway. So it's like the work is not going to go to waste.
Yeah.
Because if they don't take it, someone else will take it. Yeah. I want to quickly change topic again. I have not asked you about your poetry influences. Who have you read that you maybe want to give a shout out, recommend we take a look at them too?
Yeah, well, I think in the modern era, unfortunately, it's a lot of people that I've gotten to know and be in community with. I think Dinesh Smith is huge as in terms of an inspiration for me. They're an incredible writer, and I think do such an intricate job of capturing the human experience, but there's a lot of beauty to their work, and their attention to craft is something like their growth as a writer has been beautiful. So that's somebody else I mentioned, Ajahnay Dawkins. Again, I should know her last name. I just met her husband recently, so I should know if she took his name or not. But she's a phenomenal writer. Again, somebody who deeply engages with craft, and somebody who I feel like I'm very confident in my writing, but she's somebody who I feel like her writing can keep me on my toes. Mm-hmm. And so her work is incredible. I've always been a fan of June Jordan and her writing, because there's a beautiful, you know, I mentioned the poem, I think it's For You Have Sinned, like there's a deceptive simplicity. And that's how I always felt about June Jordan's work. Like to cut to the core of an issue in terms that everybody can understand and that may not feel like the most poetic, but then you're like, wait a minute, there's something happening here. It moved me in some way. So their work has always been incredible for me and has kind of informed me of like trying to find a balance. I get told a lot that my writing is too abstract. And most of the time I'm like, I know what I'm doing. I want it that way. But there's another piece of me too. It's like, I always want to find an entry point for readers, right? So even if it is abstract or however I want to challenge you, I want to give you a way in. I think June Jordan is one of the writers that helps me ground my work in that way, like helping folks find a way in. Because I don't want it to be inaccessible. I'm not interested in my poetry just being for the academy, right? Like it's just, that's not interesting to me. I want like the homies to read it, my mom to understand it, my brother, my fiance, all these folks to also understand where I'm coming from while also maintaining the craft. So that's why she's a huge inspiration for me. And there's a ton of other folks. You know, recently, Liz Berry, English poet, we talked about motherhood earlier. She has a pamphlet called The Republic of Motherhood, which is an incredible.
Oh, cool.
And I love that text. And I've gone back and read other, like, she's always been incredible to me at emphasizing place and putting you in community of like, here's where I come from. You're really going to know these people. And we're going to use our language and take you to the Black country in England. And place is really important for me. And that's why I really connect to her work of like, how do I represent Milwaukee everywhere I go, everything I do? How do I write how we talk? How do I tell you how we dress and be prideful of that and not shying away from it and not trying to conform to a standard? How do I do those things and still maintain the level of craft that got me an MA, right? And that's important to know that like those places, you can tell those stories and speak in those tongues and still be master level, right? Still be Pulitzer, still be MacArthur genius, whatever that thing may be. I think that's important. So those are some folks that I always like to uplift and are a big part of who I am. And, you know, there's a whole lot of other people too, even outside of poetry who inform my work.
Well, I know some of them, and then others I have not read a whole lot. Like June Jordan has definitely come up on lists, but I can't tell you that I could like name a poem of hers. So she's one I'm definitely gonna go check out. Dinesh Smith, I'll shout out the podcast Versus that he co-hosted with Franny Choi. I mean, man, my husband would sometimes catch me listening to that. And he's like, are you listening to a comedy podcast? Like, no, it's a poetry podcast. Dinesh definitely knows their craft. Mm-hmm. And I've written some academic essays on their work too. So I've like got a real appreciation, not that I've read everything, but I've got a serious appreciation for their level of commitment to the craft and how it's still like, and their podcast is fun and accessible too. I think this has been really a wonderful conversation, Deshaun. And I know we've gone over by a little bit, but I hope it was worth it. I wanted to ask you one more thing. The artwork on the cover here, can you say a little bit about what it is and how you chose it?
Well, Black Sunflowers, Amanda Holiday actually chose the artwork, and it's this Zimbabwean artist. I don't know how to pronounce her last name, so forgive me, but it's Virginia Chihota. Mm-hmm. She has all these incredible pieces. And this one, what is the name? It's You Keep Returning, But You Don't Respond to Me, or something like that. And it was like a perfect kind of fit. So like they presented it to me as an option, like they had worked with her, secure it, to make all the chapbooks kind of a lineage together that when they were releasing. Mm-hmm. And they had this one for me. And it was that idea of like, there's this gap between folks. And that's so much of what we're talking about in the text with son and father, but also just the larger idea about forgiveness. Yeah. Like this gap of this inability to respond and this kind of also cyclical nature of we keep engaging, we keep seeing each other, we keep returning to each other's lives, but there's something missing. There's an inability to bridge some gap. And so it felt like a great fit. So I was super happy when I saw the artwork and super happy that the cover was artwork, right? Mm-hmm. Like that there was something substantial there to engage with and not just the words in a color or something like, or a more traditional kind of form. And I think that's part of the beauty of having a smaller indie press to take that creative license to do something with.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of only write poetry books so that they can, you know, fill a space that is a frame for the artwork that goes on its cover. That's kind of how I feel about writing. It's like, I love those visual representations almost as much as I love the words inside, the musicality inside. And yeah, it sounds like that is a really appropriate piece. you may not have seen the piece. You can go back. You can order the book online. You can get a copy of it. You can have the artwork in front of you. But with that said, Deshaun McKinney, fabulous talking with you. And you're going to be coming to read for us in a couple of weeks. So I know this is not the last time I'll see you. But thanks for taking the time to chat with me today. And we'll see you again real soon.
I appreciate you. This was great.
You have been listening to the Poetry Salon Cast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. If you enjoyed this interview, you can find out more about the events we offer, the workshops and editing services that we host online, and a variety of other ways to get involved with the Poetry Salon by going to www.thepoetrysalon.com. You can also become a member of our free Facebook group, The Poetry Salon Online, and you can also find me, Tricia Faye Hefner, at Poet Tricia on Instagram. Thanks for listening.